eKatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of eKatra AI. Welcome back to the deep dive. Today, we're tackling something huge, something dramatic. Revolutions. We're going deep into Jack A. Goldstone's really insightful analysis. It's a work that honestly changes how you think about why states sometimes just collapse.
Yeah.
And you know, there's this puzzle at the heart of it all, isn't there? It's kind of frustrating. Why is it that some societies facing really terrible oppression, poverty, all sorts of grievances explode into revolution while others with similar problems just don't?
Right.
Think about France in 1789, the whole system overthrown. But then you look at Britain around the same time, lots of unrest there too, but the monarchy survived and adapted. Why the difference?
Yeah, that's exactly the core question. That's our mission today, really. We want to get past the surface level stuff, the dramatic figures, the catchy slogans, and look underneath. We want to dissect the structure, the mechanics of state failure.
Because Goldstone's argument, and it's powerful, is that revolutions aren't these random, unpredictable bolts from the blue. They're more like the result of pressures building up, sometimes over decades.
Right.
Predictable forces, even if the final event isn't, you know, inevitable, we're looking for the recipe, sort of.
The recipe for state collapse. I like that. Okay, so let's talk about the person who came up with this recipe, this blueprint. Jack A. Goldstone. He's a big name, right?
Oh, absolutely. Hugely influential in comparative politics, historical sociology. He's got the credentials, PhD from Harvard, currently the Amos Singletary professor. But more than that, he's known for asking the big, tough questions. He doesn't settle for easy answers.
And he brings different fields together.
Exactly. That's his distinctive thing. He combines history, economics, sociology, and creates what's called the demographic structural theory.
Okay. Demographic structural theory. Sounds a bit academic.
It sounds it, but it's actually quite practical when you break it down. It's essentially asking, can the state handle its own population? Can its finances cope? It connects these huge societal shifts, like, say, a sudden boom in the number of young people, a youth bulge, as they call it, or lots of people moving to cities. It connects those directly to the economic strain that can just cripple a government.
Makes sense.
And because he looks at this across centuries, comparing things like the English Civil War in the 1600s with, say, the Arab Spring just a decade ago, he finds these repeating patterns. That's what makes his framework so solid, so robust.
Okay, so before we dive into the how it happens, let's clarify the what. Goldstone is really specific about what counts as a revolution, right? It's not just any uprising.
Yes, very precise. It needs three key ingredients.
Yeah.
One, the state has to be forcibly overthrown, not just a change in leadership, but overthrown.
Right, force.
Two, there has to be a fundamental change in the social and political structures, like how society is organized, who holds power, that has to be shaken up completely.
Called a real transformation.
And three, there needs to be a new ideology, something radical that justifies this massive change, a new vision for society.
That distinction feels really important. Can you give an example?
Well, the classic one he uses is French Revolution, 1789. That fits all three criteria. The monarchy was overthrown by force. The old social order aristocracy, church power was dismantled. And you had this radical new ideology of liberty, equality, fraternity.
Okay, checks all boxes.
Compare that to, say, the American Revolution. Hugely important, obviously, a major war. But Goldstone might argue it was more a war of independence.
How so?
Because while the political leadership changed from British rule to American, many of the internal social structures, things like property rights, the basic elite structure within the colonies, they stayed pretty much the same, at least initially. Hmm. The scope of the social transformation wasn't as deep as in France.
Ah, I see. It's the depth of the change that defines it for him.
Exactly. And that precision lets him build his central argument, which is this. Revolutions are, first and foremost, political crises. They happen because the state itself breaks down. It's about the government losing its capacity to actually govern.
So it's less about the rebels being strong and more about the government being weak.
That's the core idea. It's incumbent failure first, then revolutionary success can follow.
Got it. Which brings us neatly to the main event, the core concept we need to unpack.
Ooh.
The revolutionary situation. You called it the fatal trifecta.
That's right, the fatal trifecta. Goldstone argues that you need three critical conditions, these structural weaknesses, to all hit at roughly the same time. It's the convergence that matters.
Okay, what are the three?
One, a severe fiscal crisis in the state. Basically, the government is going broke.
Two,
deep and crucially open divisions among the nation's elites. the powerful people are fighting amongst themselves and not supporting the regime.
And three.
Three, a high potential for mass mobilization among the general population. Lots of people willing and able to take to the streets.
Fiscal crisis, elite divisions, mass mobilization potential. All three have to be there.
All three happening together. And this, he argues, is why older theories maybe miss the mark. It's not just about class struggle, like Marx might say, or people feeling deprived. Grievances, Poverty Goldstone calls them dry wood. They exist almost everywhere, all the time.
Right, the potential is always there.
But that wood only catches fire if the state provides the spark through its own failures. If the state is financially sound and its elites are united, then widespread anger, however justified, usually just doesn't have the leverage to actually overthrow the government.
Okay, let's dig into that causal chain. How does the demographic structural stuff you mentioned earlier lead to this trifecta?
Well, think about those population dynamics. Imagine a society where the population suddenly shoots up, especially young people, that youth bulge. Suddenly, you have massive competition for limited jobs. Wages might stagnate or fall. There's huge pressure on schools, on services. And critically, the government finds itself needing to spend more, maybe on welfare, maybe on police or military, to control restless crowds. But it's tax-based. The number of good jobs and profitable businesses just can't keep up.
Yeah, spending goes up, income doesn't. Classic squeeze.
It's almost a guaranteed path towards that first leg of the trifecta, the fiscal crisis. The state's finances just buckle under the strain.
Right, the fiscal crisis.
Yeah.
The bedrock of failure, as you put it. It's like the state can't pay its bills. It can't pay the army, the police, the civil servants who make everything run.
Exactly. When it can't collect enough taxes or generate revenue to do its basic job, keeping order, delivering justice, maintaining infrastructure, it's lost its capacity. Its fundamental survival mechanism is failing.
Okay, that's leg one. What about leg two, the elite divisions? You said that might be the most critical.
Arguably, yes. Deep and open divisions among the nation's elites. Think about who the elites are. Big landowners, top military brass, powerful officials, maybe wealthy merchants or religious leaders, depending on the society. These are the people who normally benefit from the system. They're its natural defenders.
So if they're happy, the regime is usually safe.
Pretty much. Elite unity is like the regime's strongest armor. But when they start to fracture, when they become alienated, that's when things get really dangerous for the state.
What might alienate them?
Oh, lots of things. Maybe the fiscal crisis means the state raises their taxes unfairly. Maybe government policy hurts their businesses. Maybe there aren't enough good positions or opportunities for their own children within the system. Maybe they just fundamentally disagree with the direction the ruler is taking things.
I like the analogy you used. It's less about the fans booing the coach and more about the star players fighting in the locker room.
That's a great way to put it. Because when these elites defect or even just withdraw their active support, a couple things happen. First, the government loses its ability to coordinate a response to crises because its own managers are disagreeing or disengaged.
Paralyzed from within.
Right. And second, these alienated elites often provide the crucial resources, money, connections, intellectual arguments, leadership, that any opposition movement needs to become truly threatening. Street protests alone rarely have that kind of strategic capacity.
So the state can handle angry peasants, maybe, but not its own generals or bankers turning against it.
That seems to be the pattern, yes. That elite fracturing is often the tipping point.
Okay, so we have a bankrupt state, divided elites. What's the third leg again?
Mass mobilization potential. This is where the everyday people come in, the foot soldiers of the revolution, if you like.
And the demographic shifts play a role here, too.
Definitely. That youth bulge we talked about often means lots of young, unemployed or underemployed people with grievances and, frankly, not much to lose. And Goldstone also points to urbanization.
How does that contribute?
Well, think about it. If dissatisfied people are scattered across the countryside in isolated villages, it's hard for them to organize or even know others feel the same way. But pack them into rapidly growing, often poorly serviced cities.
They can find each other, talk, organize much more easily.
Exactly. Cities become these volatile hubs where news travels fast, collective anger can build quickly, and it's physically easier to gather large crowds for protests or action. The potential for collective action just skyrockets.
So fiscal crisis weakens the state. Elite division paralyzes it and provides leadership, and mass mobilization provides the numbers and the force on the ground. the fatal trifecta.
That's the model.
Do we see this play out in more recent history? You mentioned the Arab Spring earlier.
Yes, the framework applies quite well there, and also to earlier cases like the Iranian Revolution in 1979. That one's interesting.
Why? Because the Shah had oil money. Didn't seem like a fiscal crisis was the main issue.
Well, that's the thing. The regime was wealthy, yes, and had a powerful military, the Savak secret police. It looked very strong from the outside. But Goldstone analyzes it as what he calls a sultanistic regime.
Sultanistic. What does that mean in this context?
It means power and loyalty weren't really rooted in strong, independent institutions like a parliament or a legal system. Everything flowed personally to and from the Shah himself. All appointments, all decisions ultimately rested with him.
Ah, like you said earlier, brittle. Like a crystal goblet looks impressive, but one sharp knock and it shatters.
Exactly, because there are no alternative power centers or robust institutions to fall back on. And the Shah, despite the oil wealth, managed to alienate crucial elite groups.
Who did he alienate?
Key ones were the traditional clergy, who deeply opposed his secularizing reforms and saw him as a Western puppet. And also the powerful bazaar merchants, the bazaaris, who felt squeezed by economic policies and cronyism that favored the Shah's inner circle.
So even with money, he triggered that elite division.
He did. And that fractured the state's defenses. When the mass protests, often mobilized through the mosques and the bazaars, really took off, the state structure proved incredibly fragile. The military wavered, the elites were divided or hostile, and the whole thing collapsed surprisingly fast. The structural brittleness, that sultanistic nature, mattered more than the oil money.
Fascinating. And what about the aftermath? Goldstone talks about why revolutions often, well, disappoint the people who fought for them.
Yeah, that's a sobering part of the analysis. The problem is the underlying structural issues that caused the revolution in the first place, things like demographic pressure, huge state debt maybe inherited from the old regime, mass popular demands for jobs and resources, they don't just magically disappear when the dictator falls.
Boy, the problems are still there.
They are still there, and often they're worse because of the chaos of the revolution itself. So the new regime finds itself facing the exact same pressures, the same fiscal constraints, the same demands from the population.
And what does that lead to?
Often, it forces the new revolutionary government to become highly centralized, even authoritarian itself, simply to try and rebuild the state's capacity, control the population, and allocate scarce resources. It's a tragic irony they overthrow an autocrat only to sometimes become one themselves out of perceived necessity.
That explains a lot about post-revolutionary history. Okay, this leads us perfectly into summing up some of the big takeaways, the key themes from Goldstone. What's the first big message?
I think theme one has to be the centrality of state breakdown. His work really forces you to shift your focus. Stop asking only, why did the people rebel? That's important, but the more critical question is often, why was the government unable to stop them?
Right. It puts the onus back on the state's performance and resilience.
Exactly. So as a reflection for today, when you're looking at political instability somewhere in the world, try looking past the protest signs for a moment. Dig a little deeper. How healthy is the government's budget? Is its military and bureaucracy cohesive and loyal? Is the state actually functioning effectively?
So check the state's vital signs, not just the symptoms of popular anger.
Precisely. If the state's core functions are sound and its elites are mostly united, even large protests might just be manageable discontent, not necessarily the prelude to collapse.
Okay, good practical advice. What's theme two?
Theme two, elite division is decisive. We touched on this, but it's worth stressing. Elite unity is an incredibly powerful shield for any regime.
The star players sticking together.
Right. But when significant factions of the elite, the people who should be defending the system, turn against it, or even just step aside, that's often the fatal blow. They provide the legitimacy, the resources, sometimes even the military backing, that turns simple discontent into a viable challenge to power.
Yeah, you can see that playing out, not just in nations, but maybe in organizations too, right? Like in business or even community groups.
Absolutely. Think about a company facing a crisis. If the top leadership team stays united and presents a clear plan, they can often weather the storm. But if the executives start blaming each other, leaking information, or actively undermining the CEO,
the whole thing can unravel very quickly. It starts at the top.
It often does. That fracture in leadership creates a crisis of confidence that spreads downwards.
Okay, makes sense. And a third theme.
Theme three, the fragility of personalist regimes. This links back to that idea of sultanistic regimes we discussed with Iran. Goldstone highlights how regimes built entirely around one individual leader with weak or hollow institutions are inherently brittle.
The crystal goblet again.
Exactly. They might look imposing, all power concentrated in one place, but because all support, all loyalty is tied directly to that one person, if that leader is challenged, falters, or is removed, the entire system can collapse almost overnight. There's nothing else holding it together.
And that helps explain some of the really rapid collapses we saw during the Arab Spring, doesn't it? Leaders who seemed untouchable were suddenly gone.
It does. Those regimes often lacked the institutional shock absorbers that more resilient systems, even non-democratic ones sometimes, or certainly robust democracies, possess. They couldn't handle the pressure once the central figure was seriously questioned. They just snapped.
Okay, those are powerful themes.
Oh.
Goldstone also has some really memorable ways of phrasing these core ideas, almost like quotes to remember.
Yes, his analysis is very sharp. One key idea you could phrase as, revolutions are made by the collapse of the state.
Yeah, that really flips the script, doesn't it?
It does. It says the main actor, the one whose failure enables the revolution, is the incumbent regime itself. The revolutionaries are, in a sense, exploiting the vacuum created by the state's inability to govern effectively or adapt.
Puts the responsibility squarely on those in power. Mm-hmm. What's another key idea?
This one captures that difficult post-revolutionary phase we talked about. Revolutionary coalitions are marriages of convenience that typically end in divorce.
Huh. That's blunt, but probably true.
It explains so much, doesn't it? Why you so often see purges, infighting, and conflict break out almost immediately after the old enemy is defeated.
Because the groups involved, maybe they're liberals, conservatives, socialists, nationalists,
yeah.
They united only to overthrow the old regime. Their goals for what comes next are often completely incompatible.
Precisely. Once they grab power, those deep disagreements inevitably surface, and the coalition fractures, often violently.
Okay, one more key idea.
This one feels like a crucial lesson for governance everywhere. Revolutions are the price societies pay for inflexible institutions.
Ah, so if you don't bend, you break.
Essentially, yes. It suggests that the best defense against violent upheaval isn't necessarily more repression, but rather building institutions that are adaptive and responsive. Mm-hmm. Systems that allow for peaceful change, that have mechanisms for addressing grievances, for incorporating new social groups or interests.
Like strong electoral systems, maybe, or independent courts, or ways for people to actually petition the government effectively.
Exactly. Those act like safety valves. They allow the pressure that inevitably builds up in any society, from demographic shifts, economic changes, new ideas to be released or managed constructively, rather than building up until it explodes the whole system.
So flexibility and adaptation are key to long-term stability.
That seems to be the strong implication.
Okay, this framework is really powerful conceptually. How can listeners, apply these ideas in a practical way?
Well, one obvious area is in political risk assessment. If you're an investor, a business leader, or just someone trying to understand global affairs, Goldstone gives you a checklist that goes beyond the headlines.
Don't just look at GDP growth.
Right. Look deeper. How healthy are the state's finances? Is it piling up unsustainable debt? How unified are the country's elites? Military, business, political? Are there deep open fractures? Is the youth population growing rapidly without corresponding opportunities? These structural factors are often better predictors of long-term stability or instability than just economic growth figures.
That's a really useful lens for analyzing international news. What else?
You could apply the inflexible institutions idea closer to home, perhaps to organizational insight. Think about companies, nonprofits, even clubs or associations you might be a part of. If an organization's leadership becomes too rigid, too centralized, if it feels a bit sultanistic, maybe, and it consistently fails to adapt to new challenges, listen to new ideas, or accommodate the interests of its members or employees.
It increases the risk of disruption.
It increases the risk of serious internal conflict, maybe key people leaving suddenly, or even a kind of organizational breakdown. Healthy organizations, like healthy states, tend to have ways to adapt and incorporate feedback without needing a crisis to force change.
Build in those safety valves. Good point.
Right.
And for just being an informed citizen.
I think it helps provide an informed citizenship perspective. Use the structural lens to maybe temper purely emotional reactions to political events you see in the news.
Not unique.
When you see a large protest movement or political upheaval, ask yourself, okay, what are the underlying structural issues here? Is this movement actually addressing things like the state's fiscal health or deep elite divisions or the lack of opportunities for young people? Or is it mainly focused on removing one leader or protesting one specific policy?
So distinguishing between symptoms and root causes.
Exactly. Understanding the structural dimension helps you form more realistic expectations about what kind of change is possible and whether a particular movement is likely to lead to fundamental transformation or just, you know, rearrange the deck chairs.
That's a valuable filter. Okay, as we wrap up, what was the most surprising or striking thing for you in revisiting Goldstone's work?
For me, it's probably the stark emphasis on the state itself. We often focus so much on the revolutionaries, their motives, their heroism or flaws. But Goldstone really hammers home that the state's own capacity, its financial health, its internal cohesion, these are often the decisive factors. It's a less romantic view, perhaps, but a very powerful analytical one.
Yeah, what struck me too is just how predictable, in a structural sense, these massive upheavals can seem with hindsight using his framework. The cold, hard numbers, population stats, state budgets, debt levels, they tell such a crucial part of the story, maybe more than the fiery speeches sometimes.
Right. And that leads to the final thought we want to leave you with. Goldstone's work isn't just history.
No.
No, because the structural forces he identifies, things like demographic pressures creating youth bulges in some parts of the world, economic strains may be exacerbated by climate change, persistent inequality creating potential elite divisions. These forces are absolutely still at play today. They're building pressure in various places around the globe right now.
So understanding these patterns isn't just about the past.
It's about understanding the present and maybe navigating the future. It gives you a framework for thinking about political volatility and the potential for major change in the decades ahead.
A sobering but essential perspective.
Indeed.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acatra Foundation.